Good evening and welcome to Shattered Lives, a lively, educational, and issues-driven radio show designed to tell another side of the story, to focus on and humanize crime victims, to enlighten and shine the spotlight on organizations and service providers, and to assist those who walk the path with us. This is Donna R. Gore, a.k.a. Lady Justice, and your host for this evening, and my co-host, Delilah Jones, president of Imagine Publicity, the best little PR company in the whole U.S. of A. So good evening again, and I want to say welcome to everyone across the nation, and occasionally we do have international guests. It's such a pleasure to be with you each and every Saturday, and it's my pleasure to always constantly to be bringing you a variety of guests, no matter if they fall in the realm of crime victims or other type of social justice issues, and tonight is no different. And before I bring on Delilah, I just want to mention very quickly, this was a very busy, very rewarding week for me. I was in attendance at the Melanie Eileen Rieger Conference in Connecticut and met just an amazing group of people who we will have as future guests. So that was very worthwhile, as well as seeing some of our former friends and colleagues. So look forward to that in the future. And so I just want to say, you know, as by means of, by way of introduction, there is a story everyone knows called The Greatest Story Ever Told, and it was a famous movie, and it's about the life of Jesus Christ. Well, in direct contrast to that, I kind of liken tonight's guest and his book to maybe the most terrific story ever told. It has so many layers. It has horror. It has family relationships. It has a discovery that no one would ever want to discover. It has history, has multiple theories. It has paranormal, and has a very humanistic side to it. And we are going to concentrate on that. Tonight, our guest, without further ado, is Jeff Mudgett from Las Vegas, and he is a well-known author and was a practicing attorney before a life event virtually turned his world upside down and recreated a whole new vision and purpose in his life. And Delilah knows this gentleman pretty well, and they've developed a good working relationship, and it's an honor to have him. So let's bring in Delilah right now. Hi, Delilah. Good evening. What's on your mind tonight?
Hey, Donna. Well, what's on my mind tonight is talking with Jeff and, you know, getting his information out to the listeners of a totally different audience than what he's been in front of. And just to start out, he just appeared on Jillian Moss Backman's show about a week or two ago, and it was quite an experience for not only he and Jillian, but the listeners mm-hmm. as well. And apparently she wrote a wonderful introduction, which I have yet to hear because it didn't show up on the show. Anyway, I just want to read a little bit from the introduction of the book because I think it gives a little background before we bring Jeff on. He says, okay. There are no vampires between these pages or werewolves or mummies. They weren't needed. Bloodstains is the story of a real monster, my great-great-grandfather, Herman Webster Mudgett. History knows him as the infamous serial killer, Dr. H.H. Holmes, perhaps the most evil man to ever roam this planet. You'll come to know him as wickedness personified. His blood stains my soul. All of us at one time or another ponder our roots. We question whether those before us had anything to do with how we ended up. Most never learn the truth. They're usually the lucky ones. Many discover they should have left well enough alone. And how do you feel now, Jeff? Should you have left well enough alone, or how have you come to terms with all of this?
Mm-hmm. Delilah and Donna, first let me say it's a pleasure and an honor to be on the show tonight. I'm really excited and looking forward to talking to you about my shattered life, which the title of your show is just perfect for Bloodstains, my book. So I was really excited about coming on. But your question starts off great because when, you know, I've been working on my book now for 10 years, more than 10 years. And mm-hmm. for most of that time, Delilah and Donna, I considered having made, you know, a tremendous mistake in my life, having not left well enough alone. Just the last year or so, my life's turned the other way to where I now know writing this book and coming up with the truth about what this monster actually was my destiny, and it's made me a better man, and I'm quite happy I did it.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Why don't you, you know, briefly give some background maybe on Holmes and exactly who he was and how he came to be related to you, but how you discovered this. You didn't know this growing up, and your family didn't know this. So give the audience a little background there.
Yeah, many of your readers might know him as the Devil in the White City. He's the main character in Eric Larson's famous book, which is being made into a movie by Warner Brothers right now with Leonardo DiCaprio. I didn't know this was my relative, my direct descendant. I was a direct descendant of this monster until I was about 40 years old, Delilah, when my grandfather was forced to admit to the entire family this secret that he had kept his entire life, even from my grandmother, who would not have married my grandfather had he told her the truth.
Really? Wow.
Oh, no. And that's the type of woman she was. She went through life trying to prove that we were related to General Robert E. Lee. Instead, she even talked my mother into giving me the middle name Lee. But when she found out that it was the other direction, she handled it rather well. I didn't. Mostly as I because as I describe in the book, my grandfather, pretty much while the whole family heard the secret, he was aiming it at me alone for reasons I didn't understand at the time. And I tried to explain in the book why that was. So it was something that, you know, before I came to that knowledge, Delilah, I was a practicing attorney in California, a successful man who's, you know, the normal race for the biggest house, the fastest car, the sleekest boat, that type of thing. But I wasn't a happy man. I was rather bitter, proceeding on my own direction, not toward evil or crime, but I wasn't thrilled with where my life was going. And I couldn't tell why I was different from everyone else, with different instincts and different impulses, more directed toward this thing in the book. But I didn't know. And then that one night I found out, and then went on a journey to discover what the truth was, having learned, reading every book ever written about him, Donna, that most of what you read about this monster was legend and probably untrue. So I started at the beginning and worked on it for over 10 years.
Wow, that's interesting. And so you actually felt a physical difference then, you were saying. You perceived that?
Yeah, when you're driving, Delilah, and someone cuts you off on the road and you have that impulse, oh, I could kill that guy. Do you ever do that? Like, I think most people do.
Mm-hmm.
for me, it was a little more concrete. It was a little more firm, and I always knew I had to pull back something inside me, something of my genetics, something of my DNA, which really wanted me to hurt that fella. And I had given up thinking it was just the normal thing for a man in our society to feel like. And instead, as I explain in the book, I used to, when I had those feelings and they started to bubble up, I'd try to go fishing, try to be by myself and to go out and talk to myself, calming down and getting back to a normal life. So when I learned that this, and basically the story, it's about a man confronted with the knowledge that he owes his very existence to this monster. Because let's face it, I wouldn't be here talking to you, Donna, right now, mm-hmm. if it weren't for the conscious decisions of the most evil man that ever lived. And if you want me to go over his history a little bit for your listeners, I'd be glad to do it.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea.
Yeah. He was born in 1861 in New Hampshire. He married, had a son, which was my great-grandfather. He moved to Michigan. He went to the University of Michigan Medical School, where he obtained a degree, full degree as physician and doctor. He had one of the highest IQs ever recorded there. This is the definition of evil genius. He then spent much of his life perfecting life insurance fraud. He would see a couple, a wealthy couple. He would murder the husband. He would then have the widow fall in love with him. He looked like a movie star. He was very elegant, very mannered. He could hypnotize. He was the master of enslaving another human being. He would have the widow name him as the beneficiary on her life insurance policy, and then she would simply disappear, to where in the 1890s, Donna, he was making $300,000 or $400,000 a year by estimates, which...
Wow. I heard that earlier. Wow. It's incredible.
What he did then was, what I try to do is explain in the book that this man, when you see a legal dictionary and they try to define what premeditated is, it should have his face, his picture, his photo on it. Because what he did then was he realized that the Chicago World's Fair was coming to the Midwest on the lake, and he knew that there would be 20, 30, 40 million people from all over the world visiting. So he spent the next 2, 3, 4 years constructing a hotel pharmacy with an elaborate basement down below, at the junction between where the railroads would meet before those tourists would go out the next day to visit this event that they had waited their entire life for, the Chicago World's Fair. And he knew they had to have a place to stay that night, Donna. So he constructed, designed from bottom up, a murder castle, a factory of death, which unfortunately up until now has gone largely unknown by our society, and it's the most horrible thing you could possibly imagine. And I think now with the story, with the movies coming out, with the documentaries this summer to be released, we're going to see exactly how horrible this is, and not just for one man. I think with shows like yours, this gives us the opportunity to appreciate and recognize what human beings are capable of doing, and maybe, just maybe, defining finally what evil really is. It's not a mental disorder. It's not some abuse when they were a child. It's a selection. It's a choice by this man who could have, he was so intelligent, Donna, he could have been a Louis Pasteur. He could have solved, cured illness and disease. Instead,
but he chose to go the other way.
He went
because
the
of
other.
His boredom, his constant boredom, right? That was one thing that I heard. He was just never satisfied with doing one thing, then he kind of switch over to different kinds of victims, et cetera.
I've never heard the bored angle. It could be true. I'm not that close to how his life went. I know he had a good mother and father. He grew up well. He just made a choice. He made a selection. He was, clearly psychopathic, but many, many people are psychopathic in our society today, and they don't murder. He decided to go evil, and he enjoyed doing it. He made a career of torture, experimentation. This is the definition of what a real-life Frankenstein was. And that basement at that murder castle, when the facts finally come out, I know there are two studios now in Hollywood that are probably going to rebuild the hotel on their sets, so that the world finally has a chance to see what it was really like with the acid baths, with the furnaces down below. This man killed hundreds of innocent people, and he knew, he was smart enough to know that the way he was going to be caught was the remains after his torture and experimentation, and he designed a system, a factory, to do away with these remains.
Wow,
that's
kind of incredible.
In my estimation, sort of the precursor of Hitler. I mean, some of the things that he, is said to have done in Murder Castle are, very much like the atrocities during the Holocaust, only on a smaller scale. So, we kind of hold up Hitler as the personification of evil, but this is even before Hitler, where, it was done very, very similarly. And it was interesting to me, Jeff. You feel like you had some personal demons and some personal questions about yourself before the discovery of Holmes being your relative, correct?
Oh, yeah. I had demons. I knew that, like I said, I was different. I had never committed crime. I didn't hurt people intentionally. But I had to fight those things back. And when I learned that this was where I came from, it all made a lot of sense, Delilah. And that's one of the reasons when I try to write the book, I don't want someone of your listeners to think, if they want to buy a book that describes Jack the Ripper or the methods that H.H. Holmes used to murder these innocent victims, that's not what my book's about. This book is about someone like me learning these facts about their soul, about, you know, my blood being stained by this monster and how it changed my life. Because what I'd like your listeners and my readers to do is when they open the book, I'd like them to take my hand and step into my shoes and decide what they would have done in my place had they been me. And I get a lot of comments from readers saying that the book made them look at a number of things in their own lives about their own demons, and they thank me about it. So that's very satisfying.
Yeah. Well, it's a very personal account.
Yeah. It is probably the most roller coaster psychological story I've ever read. I mean, it was interesting from page one clear to the end for me. And, you know, I just want anybody out there who's even thinking about reading this to pick it up and get it. Mm-hmm. You can go to bloodstainsthebook.com and order it direct, and you can also get it on Kindle. But it answered a lot of questions, and yet at the end there were so many more questions that, you know, I'm waiting for the sequel. I'm waiting for more, because that's how the book ended. It left me wanting more. And you're right. The reader tends to put on your shoes, and all the way through you're thinking, what would I do? Could I do that? Could I survive this? But it's a definite story of the human condition and the fight between good and evil, and you lived it. That's the difference. It's not just a story. You lived it. It was your reality.
You know, and you've explained it wonderfully, and what I tried to do in the book was during these 10 years, I developed epilepsy, and I'd never had it before. A number of my best friends think it has something to do with the Holmes curse, which the New York Times wrote about, you know, 100 years ago, about the 40 or 50 people after he was allegedly executed that either died or suffered terrible misfortune. Now, what I try to give my readers, Delilah, is the choice. Did that epilepsy and those seizures that I take medicine for now, and I'm one of the lucky ones, the medicine works for me. Some people I know, I'm a part of the Epilepsy Foundation. I just did a show the other night for the NSDF, which is another great epileptic function. A lot of those people suffer 20, 30 seizures a day, and their life is hell. It's just hell, and like I say, I'm one of the lucky ones. But I give my readers the chance. If you want to believe that these voices and visions that visited me, you know, from Holmes, were a part of the paranormal, a part of the supernatural, the spiritual, you can. But I also allow you the opportunity to state that, you know, these are a result of that medical condition I had and the tumor in my head that my doctor said caused these visions I had. Now, Delilah and Donna, what you'll find reading the book is so many of these coincidences that I write about in the book are now being proven true, which are pretty hard for me to have made up out of cold in order to put down in a book. So I'm enjoying that a lot, like the thing we're doing now, trying to prove or solve the Jack the Ripper murders as H.H. Holmes. So we're enjoying that a lot. Some of the old history that is emerging is amazing stuff.
Jeff, after your tumor was removed, was that a turning point in terms of your lack of hearing voices or seeing visions? Did that make a difference in terms of, you know, changing your medical conditions after the tumor?
You know, I didn't allow them to remove it. It was a decision about risky where it was. And I decided to live it out. And funny thing, when I published the book, Donna, the tumor actually receded to where now I'm fine. I'm healthy. I'm, like I say, I'm epileptic, but in control of my situation. So that's another one of those coincidences, that tumor deciding to recede once I published the book emphasize what I thought was the truth about this monster. So, maybe that was what was intended to happen the whole time.
Yeah, sounds like you made the right decision for you. Yeah.
I think so.
Yeah. Delilah?
Well, I was just going to ask you, when you wrote the book and going into all of the discovery, you know, how long did it take you to get through? And I don't want to give away a lot of the book, but you discovered the diaries of Holmes. How did in the world did you get through these diaries? And there again, you know, that can explain, because I think it would drive me a little wacky. But what was your feeling as you were going through reading them and finding out just, I mean, the truth and exactly what he did to these poor people?
Yeah, and let me state that Bloodstains is a story about me being given diaries by my grandfather after he died from H.H. Holmes, and trying to put together the differences in those diaries with what the books stated and the newspapers had written about this monster. It was difficult at first, because one thing you come to realize very quickly, Delilah, is not only was he the most prolific serial killer of all time, he was the most prolific liar of all time. Anything that he said had a motive, had a purpose, and was probably a lie. That's what I came to find out. So most of the books written today and all of the articles that you can pull up from the Chicago papers, the New York papers, the Philadelphia papers, the London papers, they all were based on the memoirs that he wrote while he was in prison awaiting execution. His alleged execution. So when you went to try to decipher what was said in those memoirs and what was said in the diary, as I wrote about it in the story, they weren't the same. They were completely opposite. And as you realize that everything he wrote had a purpose, you know, you've got to start over. You've got to go backwards, Delilah, because anything that someone has come up with a contention or has conjectured about concerning Holmes is wrong. And that not only – I was a researcher in California as a lawyer, and researching is fun for me. So that gave my life a direction which I needed at the time, and I'm glad that it did. So, you know, now we've got – I mentioned already proving that we have solved the greatest true crime mystery there is. As soon as that's over and we obtain a little more funds, we're going to dig up his concrete grave in Philadelphia to prove that he was never executed, that his guard was hanged in his place, that H.H. Holmes walked out in the middle of daylight with no gunfire, no violence, just walked out in the middle of daylight, which may be one of the most incredible escapes in the history of man. And then when we prove that, which will be very easy to prove, by the way, because once we have the permission from the federal government to exhume that grave and compare the remains with my DNA, we'll be able to state 100-0 whether it's him or not, which is very satisfying. And
so you're going to give a DNA sample, and they're going to take a DNA sample from whoever is entombed and compare them, and that will be the direct evidence?
That's right. And the Smithsonian is going to take possession of those remains, which I was totally in agreement with, because I didn't want it to be a Geraldo Rivera event.
Right.
I wanted it to
incredible.
Have credibility.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And when they take possession and they give it to their scientists to do the DNA with my tissue, I didn't know. I thought DNA testing took a few days. Well, it takes months, if not a year, for that a degree age. Yeah, generations. It's not as simple as I thought it was. And it's very expensive because we were just going to go do it. I had already submitted a request with the government and the state of Pennsylvania, and it came back that having to dig up the grave, having to break open the remains scientifically, having to give them to the Smithsonian and pay for all the DNA testing, we were talking over $100,000, and I don't have that yet, but one day we will. And right mm-hmm. now we're talking to the National Geographic and the History Channel about them funding this event and putting it on TV, which I think would be very exciting.
Oh, you almost have to do that. And then you have that other direct evidence that you tell people about. I don't know if you want to mention that with regard to the handwriting.
Sure. And that relates to him being Jack the Ripper when your listeners would like to go look at some of the direct evidence. I had my web expert do that for your show today. They put up a couple of pieces of direct evidence on the homepage. At the top of the page, in 2006, the Scotland Yard and the BBC created a computer schematic of what Jack Ripper looked like. Most people don't realize this, Delilah, but there were 13 eyewitnesses to Jack the Ripper. So in 2006, when they had their computer, which is their main tool on catching serial killers, along with DNA, obviously, but computer schematic gives them that general direction in which to go, in which they find very helpful, they've told me. We put that up on the homepage of the website, but then I had my computer man lay in a photo of Holmes over the top of that schematic. And you can take a look at it, but it's very similar. When that was finished, I took it to two detectives in Virginia that used to do that for a living. They used to compare schematics with photographs, and when they described to me how they would look at the structure of the nose, the eyes, the chin, the ears, they said, this comparison is probably the closest they've ever seen in their entire career. So you have a general description that Holmes looked like what the eyewitnesses saw the nights of the Ripper killings, okay? Then if you go down to the bottom of that homepage, after I published my book, Donna, I had a man contact me, Mark Potts, who's an expert historian on true crime. If you ever get a chance, you probably have him on your show. But he told me that he'd been studying for about 10 years. It was his contention as well that Holmes was Jack the Ripper. He had some handwriting. He had the original handwriting that Holmes had done in the prison cell awaiting his alleged execution. He had taken it to London and let the British Library examine it, who recommended their expert to compare it with the Dear Boss and the From Hell letters, the famous Jack the Ripper letters. She came back with a conclusion that said it was a match. Now, having practiced law in California, I knew that the Supreme Court had largely thrown out handwriting analysis and expert as far as capital cases are concerned, because you can get an expert to say yes, you can get an expert to say no. Well, right. the Department of Justice knew they needed handwriting on many of their crimes and cases. So they contacted an outfit at the University of Buffalo who created a computer program to compare handwriting. So I contacted them, and they ran the Ripper letters through their computer with the Holmes handwriting. And the results of their analysis at the bottom of my homepage, along with me standing giving a talk at a conference comparing the handwriting itself, their computer came up with a number of 97.95% similarity, which is way, way, way up there, probably higher than you two could get right now if you wrote two comments on different pieces of paper and we ran it through the same computer. It also allows your listeners to take a look with their own eyes, Donna, and just take a look at eyes, the U's, the R's of the two handwriting samples, and you can see it doesn't take an expert to see it's the same hand.
So, yeah, even the untrained eye can see that. You know, that is very amazing. It really is. But with respect to the theme of the aftermath. You talk about, you know, this is the stain on your soul, and I would kind of liken it to the whole coming out process, and I'm not talking about the gay community, but it's almost similar to that in terms of revealing, you know, a deep secret. And what were the family dynamics with that, both personally, you coming out to yourself, and then, you know, with the family, and then with the community at large?
Excellent. My family hated that I was writing this book the first few years. My mother is my mother. My mother would deal with me no matter what I did, okay? That's who she is. My father was angry with me. My sister still has a hard time talking to me about it. The rest of the family was largely quiet, even when I explained to them that, listen, there's so many books and movies coming out now about, you know, our ancestor. Let's get out front and tell the world our story about it. They didn't want to. They wanted to do what the family had done 100 years ago, which was run away to California to get away from the stigma involved in, you know, in who this man was, which was fair. But I refused to give that up. And I'd argue with them and go on the shows, and I'd get these same questions about why would you have written a book seeming to be proud that this man is your ancestor? Well, it was difficult for me. I had a hard time answering those questions because they're not easy. Well, mm-hmm. It all came one day, Delilah, during an interview I did with Chris Williams, you know, the gal that used to be on Ghost Hunters?
Right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she put me on a show. She's the host of the Ancestry.com radio blog now. And we were on the show, and she started working it backwards for me, stating that, you know, Jeff, most people, when they go to Ancestry.com, they're looking for some ancestor that was a king or a president, something like that. And then when they get these conclusions, they're a little bit disappointed in where their family direction went. You, on the other hand, you know that your ancestor was the worst possible you could ever have, anyone could ever have, other than, like you say, Adolf Hitler, maybe. She said, but you know what? That's something to be proud of. That's something to broadcast, because every member of your family after him was good, God-fearing citizens, Americans, two war heroes, very successful people, charitable functions, the whole thing, that have assisted our society in making it a better place. And that should be something your family is proud of. Not only did you have these terrible genetics and DNA, but you all went the right direction, making the right choices, and it shows how good a family you are. And you know what? That's my position now, Delilah. And I really enjoy spouting that when I go on shows like this.
Yeah, well, you know, it's contrast.
It is another question in my mind, and another question I'm sure in a lot of listeners would be, you know, going through all of this and finding out who your ancestor is. Like you just talked about, your family did a lot of great things. They grew, you know, they grew along through life as good, upstanding citizens. Where had they gone the other way, had they not been such good people, let's say, do you think that in an instance like that, hypothetically, then you'd have something to blame it on? Then you'd have, you know, well, look where we came from. So, ta-da.
Absolutely. And what this does, Delilah, is it gives us proof, all right? This gives us definitive proof that it doesn't matter where you come from. Because let's face, just run the numbers. I can show you how these numbers work. But here's a man, Donna, that had 200 mistresses at least. He had 6 wives. I don't know how many children he had, probably 30, 40, 50, 60 kids out there. Now, when you run those numbers off generational, you're talking about now millions maybe that are related to him in some way or fashion. So we now know, having seen what my family did despite coming directly from him, that it has nothing to do with your genetics or DNA. It has to do with knowledge. It has to do with the truth we all come to in our lives, if we're lucky enough, like I was, and then making the right decision, selection, or choice, which we see so much about in articles and papers and books. But,
right.
But this instance pretty much proves it has nothing to do with the other thing. It's who we are as a person and where we decide we want to go. And I like being the messenger for that proof. I really do.
And then you'll have more proof positive once you do the DNA analysis, you know, that it doesn't really matter. There's behavior and there's genetics. Have you talked to a genetic counselor about these findings just to have them reiterate what you just told us?
No, I never have, because this is who I'm descended from. There's no doubt about that. I just, my contentions, Donna, are that he was not executed. He was not hanged. The guard was hanged in his place. He went on to live a long life, killing many hundred more innocent victims.
And you'd have no qualms about having, I don't know if you are married, you have children. It was like, would that have stopped you from saying, oh, my goodness? Well, knowing what you just said, I would say the answer obviously is no. But maybe other people, they would take pause and say, gee, if I come from that, maybe I shouldn't have children.
Yeah, well, my child is 25, so, you know, we had her long before I ever knew about H.H. Holmes. I'd never heard of him, as a matter of fact.
Okay.
But I can see your question is a valid one for someone in my position, had they the knowledge before they decided to raise children, for sure.
Yeah. Well, it's just amazing. It truly is. Delilah?
Yes.
you can go ahead if you like. I have a couple others, but I'm giving you the reins. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, talking to Jeff has always been a super fascinating, and like,
yeah.
I said, this book has, you know, I get books all the time, and I really and truly appreciate it, and I just don't have time to read them all. But when his came in the mail, and I always pick them up, I always read the foreword or the prologue and get started on chapter one, and then get distracted or something else happens. No, not with this one. I did.
Jeff, I'm a witness. She read it all the way through. She was emailing me and said, oh, God, you have to read this book. So she really did.
You know, while we're on the subject of reading the book, though, I'd like to be careful. I like to beware of some people. And, Delilah, you can help with this. This book is not for everyone. It's not for immature audiences, for sure. This is probably one of the most terrifying books you're ever going to read. I had one reviewer tell me that Stephen King needs to move over. This is more horrific than his work. And people are telling me, Donna, that about 20 pages in, they feel something come alive in themselves when they read the book. And it quickly becomes about them, not about me anymore. And most people, Donna, are telling me they're happy they read the book. But I have some people come up to me. I've had a couple at functions screaming at me that I should have been ashamed of myself for writing this book. So I want people to beware. If you want to know something maybe about yourself that is laid dormant for all your life, pick up Bloodstains and take a look. You just may learn something about good and evil and the definition you've had about them your whole life. So, but as Delilah can help me, most people are very happy. And they thank me for writing the book, so it's
well, I think as well, if the readers have some background knowledge of Holmes and who he was, I mean, I read Devil in White City when it first came out years ago, so I did have at least that much background, because I had never heard of him before until I read that book. So, you know, I think Devil in White City serves as a good sort of primer to your book, and if they bring them both together, they're going to get a totally different outlook, in my opinion. And that helped me get through the book, because I was already knew the worst of the worst, but you tend to bring it out in a totally different way, and it's so personalized because you're in it, you're in the story. So I think that's where readers, myself included, start personalizing it. It's like, okay, I talked to this guy over the phone before. How can this be? So in that way, yes, you do. You find yourself in your shoes, in there wondering, you know, are we going to get out of this or are we going to get out? So it's a roller coaster. It's totally a roller coaster and a wonderful one at that.
You know, I'll tell you an interesting thing that happened. I didn't have an agent. I didn't try to sell the book in Hollywood, but I was contacted by one of the studios. They had read the book, and they wanted me to come to Los Angeles to talk with them about them making a movie from Bloodstained. So when I went in, I talked to Delilah about this. I was firmly expecting them, Donna, to write a book about Jack the Ripper, to write a book about the murder castle and killing torture down in the basement. So when I went there, they had asked me to write up a treatment, and a treatment is basically a blueprint for a movie script. And I hadn't ever done it before, but I did some studying and I put one together. And when I gave them my treatment, they said, no, that's not what we're looking for. We want the movie to be your story. We want it to be about what happened to you when you found out that this devil was in your background. That's what we want the movie to be about. And they said that historical thing, you know, having to do a movie about what he was 125 years ago is why they're having trouble at Warner Brothers with Leonardo DiCaprio putting that movie about the devil in the White City out. And they have their doubts that it's ever going to be finished again. So they wanted to make it that personalized thing that Delilah just explained. And when I walked out of the room that the conference that day, it was very satisfying to hear that, you know, they appreciated the story the way it was told.
And I think the other thing, you know, I'd like to really have you go briefly into the writing process, the writing and publishing. And you know, I know you just did a presentation for a writer's club in San Diego. And touch on that for some of our listeners, because I know a lot of our listeners are first-time authors or second-time authors or wannabe authors. What kind of advice can you give to them?
Yeah, thank you very much. I enjoy doing this a lot. I've been told that I'm a solid writer. I'm not one of the great writers like the authors that make fortunes off this. But what I think, Delilah, is this Amazon and this ability to self-publish now, because that's what I did with my book. I had a couple of offers from publishing houses in New York, but their conditions were so
stringent.
They tried control the content of my book, and you know me, Delilah, I can't do that. There's no way I can't do that. They're not going to control how I write my book. And I refused. I wanted to do it myself, even though people told me it would never work. Okay. So I gave it a shot. And I think Amazon and the ability to self-publish now is the greatest First Amendment right we've ever had as Americans. I really do. It's amazing. Next year there may be 5 million books for sale on Amazon. Think of that. 5 million.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no one deciding who gets to do it. You get to do it yourself. So I told Delilah, I would love to go around the country and explain the mistakes that I made, you know, publishing my own book, doing it the wrong way, having to redo it, spending silly money with these mistakes, and maybe just cause a few great writers to, you know, skip those things that I did and come out with a masterpiece one day. I was very excited about doing that. So I've been giving some talks lately to prospective writers about putting your book together, what I found sells in the market today. And also, they're the most fascinated with, Donna, that whole thing of movie studio calling you up and wanting to make a movie of your book, which, you know, is every author's dream.
Yeah. So how do you go from the book to the movie? Is that a very complex process? And they do want control, don't they?
The movie studio has complete control. You have nothing to say about that whatsoever.
Okay.
And I knew that from the start. That's one thing that gives me a good laugh, Delilah, is we had these people, these authors, complaining that their book was changed when a movie was made. Well, come on. You're talking about a piece of literature that's 20 or 30 hours to read being turned into this piece of art that's 2 hours long. It's an incredibly difficult thing to do, and you've got to give the movie studio some slack. Plus, we're talking about an outfit spending $100 million on your book. They need to make sure it sells enough tickets, you know, and DVDs that they
talk
get
about
the money.
Pressure.
Oh, yeah, they all lost their career. And so I don't have that feeling at all. I know it will be different from my book, and I'm going to enjoy it no matter what comes out. I really have already set my mind at that. But
that's a good attitude. It is, because you don't want to set yourself up for failure or disappointment, you know?
Yeah, and they've asked me to help in the process. They've asked me to help with reviewing dialogue, and they want me to help pick the director that they're going to hire. They want me to help. They've already sent me lists of the actors they're considering playing me and then playing H.H. Holmes. So it's exciting. I'm having a great time with it. But I can only tell your listeners this, and, you know, we've only got a few minutes, so I'll try to keep it down. But there's so much negative talk about Facebook these days, and Facebook is an incredible mechanism for a prospective writer to use to get his book out there so that it's illustrated. Not necessarily sell it off Facebook, but you need to get it illustrated. And if you have a story which fascinates your friends on Facebook, you can be a successful writer in today's day and age. And I'm telling people, don't be negative about that mechanism. It's an incredible thing. Get on Facebook, put 30 minutes, an hour in it every day. Build it up so that you have a machine that projects your story forward. And I think that's one of the major steps you need to do.
Well, I think we all do that as clients of Delilah's too. We try to personify the issues that are important to us and who we are and where we want to go. But if you're talking strictly about your book, it kind of makes sense. That's true. Listen, I have a question.
Well, it's all about engagement and involvement, and that's what you learn in social media, whether it be Facebook, Twitter, Google+, LinkedIn, any of the good, you know, platforms for social media, networking, and that's exactly what it is. It's networking. It's getting out there, meeting different people, just as if you were in a room. You know, so many times now, even conferences like the one you went to this week, Donna, a lot of them are now doing them online. So we've become a society of finding the ability to meet online, engage online, and, you know, become friends or clients or whatever. You know, that's where you're finding everything these days. So you have to learn, and this is, you know, for authors, first-time authors especially, if you're not savvy in the ways of social media, you really need to get there and start learning how to do it properly, you know, how to engage your audience. And you know, you guys do it great. Jeff, before you even became a client, I told you, you're doing everything right. So, you know, I love to see the engagement you have with the followers on Facebook, and that's what's going to help sell books.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
That is great. I have a question. Do you think that you're going to be engrossed with this topic for, say, the next 5-10 years, and then you're going to move on to something else, or will this always be part of your fabric and it will just kind of never leave the forefront of your mind?
No, I'm finishing my audio book on bloodstains now. I've got one of my best friends. He's an actor. He was up for an Emmy last year on House. He was in the book. He was actually in the book when we went down into the basement of the Murder Castle, the post office now in Chicago. But he narrates the story. We're finishing that now. As a matter of fact, I'll send you a copy when it's done through Delilah so you can listen. But
thank you. That'd be wonderful.
I will. When that is finished, I'm not going to work on bloodstains anymore. Instead of when Delilah sets me up with a conference or a talk, obviously, Bloodstains is the one that the movie studio bought, so that's the subject that you know you have to use. But I'm going to write a sequel, but it's not the same by any stretch of the imagination. It's a love story, and if you can imagine that this monster actually had a love, and he did, which is shocking to me. And when he was, and I'll give you just a short example. When he was let off after being sentenced to death by the jury and judge, the New York Times wrote about the six women in the audience behind him, Donna. The women The women who knew what he was, they knew exactly what he was. These were good, strong women who fell in love with this monster. They stood up, they knew that they were one of many, and they bawled these huge tears that the New York Times was fascinated with. I want to write a love story. I want to write it, though, from the perspective of one of these women. How did they possibly love this monster? That's
right.
That's something that's fascinating to me, and I think that's something that needs to be maybe, you know, dug into a little bit and discovered. How does that work? How does love for that serial killer, that thing that enjoyed torture, become a real thing? And that's, I want to write about that. I'm about halfway through that now. And then I'd like to write just some pure fiction pieces about pirate gold and things like that. I just kind of enjoy like writing a little bit about fun things.
Do you anticipate going back to becoming an attorney? Or is this your path in life?
No, this is my destiny. I'm enjoying writing. I enjoy talking to people at conferences, mm-hmm. at clubs. I'm thrilled about being able to talk about epilepsy. I just did a show to the parents of children with epilepsy, trying to explain to these parents what to see when their child has a seizure. Because I went through years before I found a neurologist who had epilepsy himself that understood what I was going through. The others were ignorant.
Yeah, right.
Sure, they'd gone to a university. They'd gone to a university. They knew how to administer the medicine, that type mm-hmm. of thing. But they didn't understand the life I was living. And the one that finally did changed my life. And so I'm trying to transport that information he gave to me to these parents so that they can give their children, you know, a reasonable life, because that epilepsy can be a horrible thing.
Yeah, and, you know, it's just a testament to what a bad event in your life, or this is not an event, it's an entire, you know, generation, multi-generational thing, we can still take those things and pay it forward, and there can be positive outcomes, and no matter what happens to us, how horrific. I truly believe in that.
I do, too. That pay it forward thing, it's...
Mm-hmm.
I don't think enough people take advantage of it. And when you do it, whether it's just helping somebody with a parking spot or picking up something they spill in the grocery store, Delilah, you know, you feel mm-hmm. so good about that the rest of the week. It's amazing. I try to do it any chance I get now.
Well, there's certainly
a wonderful
lot of
concept. And you're right. It does work. And, you know, it's interesting because I had a conversation just the other day with someone you sent my way, John Barrett Hawkins, and, you know, just real quickly, his story was he was in prison for 20 years, and he came out, and, you know, now he's actually learned some very positive things in prison, and he's now speaking with in high schools. But that was one of the things that we talked about that was very important to him at this time in his life, is learning how and teaching others how to pay it forward. You know, go to three people, do that thing, and watch what happens when it comes back to you. It's mm-hmm. amazing.
I didn't know he'd been in prison 20 years. I would have checked with you first before I sent him to you.
It's okay.
It's really okay. It was only over the phone. Don't worry, Jeff. It was just a phone call.
Okay.
Yeah. But I'm very grateful to you for sending him my way, because he was, you know, I think you should get to know him a little bit. He's a very fascinating guy, and he's doing some good things. He really is.
He was,
the experiences he had.
At the Writers Club, he was very probative in his questions. He was like a laser, and the other ones were just kind mm-hmm. of enjoying the whole story overall. And he wanted to know information that was going to help his book for sure. And he was very different. He was very different there. And, you know, Delilah, I can tell you one thing. I've had four agents now in 2 years, and it's like I finally found my pot of gold with you and how to help. And I tell you, I'm going to send as many other authors I can your way as I possibly come in contact with, and hope you're ready, because it's going to be a lot.
I guess I better get ready, huh?
Holy cow.
Well, I appreciate your kindness, I think.
You better take your vitamins, Delilah.
You know, that's what I've said, too. And everybody who knows me and knows that you're, you know, in the Imagine Publicity stable, I said, you know, he's the most fascinating guy I've ever talked to. And you and I got on the phone. It was like, you know, we knew each other for a long time. It was kind of a weird thing. But I'm excited about your future, and it's great to be along for the ride, especially.
Yeah.
Well,
it sounds it.
It's going to be fun to see where it leads. It's actually the pressure's gone now for obvious reasons. You know, if the book doesn't sell another copy, the Hollywood people have made it, you know, the book a successful thing as far as, you know, feeding my family. So that makes it easy. And all of a sudden I'm finding out that people like the book a lot more now that they've relaxed, that I'm not trying to sell it so hard. So it just, like you say, everything kind of goes in a circle and things seem to come back to you when you, you know, I told these people at that club the other day, Donna,
yep.
when you write a book these days, it's a hobby. It's a hobby. You have to have a career in something else. Write your book, but don't expect to be an overnight sensation. It's going to take you a lot of time and a lot of work. So do it so that it satisfies your inner sense about being a writer. And then when it becomes successful, you know, you spun the wheel of fortune and you hit on the bonus. And that's
the
way
you can enjoy it all the more. Yeah. I have a question about, you know, the movie aspect. Do you feel as if this is going to be geared toward reality or entertainment? And which would you prefer? I mean, or is it a combination of both?
Oh, I want it to be a psychological thriller. I want it to be like I love Stephen King movies like The Shawshank and The Green Mile, those type of things.
Mm-hmm.
I want it to be like that. Now, the three movies that they brought up, Donna, were,
uh-huh.
and they're some of my favorite. One was Seven, the one with Brad Pitt. Do you remember
mm-hmm.
that one?
Mm-hmm.
The other one was The English Patient. They wanted to go back and forth in present and past time like that did. And then They also, and I love The English Patient, and then they also brought up The Usual Suspects. They were fascinated with the structure of that movie as far as Bloodstains was concerned. So I'm quite excited about it being a movie that scares the heck out of someone that goes to watch it on a feature.
Well, I'm sure it will. And if you can get past the first 20 pages, like you said, and doesn't terrorize you, I think those of us who have been through a lot have a good constitution and can make it through. Right, Delilah?
Oh, I think so. I think, yes, you will enjoy it. Get your copy today.
Yeah.
And everyone else out there, go to bloodstainsthebook.com and order your copy. And it's coming out on audio. You can get it on Kindle. And then watch for the sequels. I'm really excited about the future of your writing because I think, there again, the way you wrote the book was very good as well. And I was like, this is a first-time writer. The way you put words together was all part of the story. It really, it wove the whole tapestry to me.
Well, thank
like
you very
explode.
Much.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. And I'll tell you what, for friends and listeners of Shattered Lives and Delilah and Donna, for allowing me to come on the show at this late minute, tell my manager, Kelly, that you found out about the book from today's show, and I'll have him send you a signed copy with your order.
Oh,
so.
My goodness. You're such a good man. You're going to have to come back and tell us about another layer of the onion that you haven't revealed in the future, okay? Can I get that on record?
Yeah, and you tell you what, let's give me a few months, and then let me come back and tell you about the movie process, turning
Very
a
good.
Book. Because I don't know how it works, but it fascinates me, and I'd love to come on your show and describe it to your listeners.
That would be excellent. Well, we thank you so much. It's been an incredible ride this evening, and I want to thank everyone, all the listening audience. Please go to www.donnagore.com and imaginepublicity.com. Be sure to listen to Shattered Lives next week for a lively and informative episode. Thank you so much, Jeff. Thank you, Delilah. And we'll talk to you soon. Good evening, everyone.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.